So we'll be picking up in chapter 47 and summarizing some highlights. That's really the best you can do in a Bible class setting like this. You have to pick and choose. But the Bible class is not... Why am I going off on this? The Bible class is not the end. The Bible class is a launching pad for your studies so that you further understand things. So, and hopefully it's done that in the book of Genesis. I get sad whenever you have the last class of something. I'm a little bit sad because you hate to leave it, but then we have something new. So, Ray Conies, could you open us with a prayer, please?
Heavenly Father, thank you that we can approach you now in prayer. And thank you, Lord, that we're together at this time in this place. It's a blessing in many ways to understand why we're here on this earth and the purpose you give us in serving you through your Son. And bless this effort here in this class and all of us as students. Philip as teacher, and thank you for the messages we've had and the messages we'll hear today that'll help edify us and help us in our own personal study, as Philip just mentioned. And that we grow as a result and we're better able to serve you. We ask in your Son's name. Amen.
So how are things going for Jacob's family down in Egypt? In Egypt? Really well. How's it going for the Egyptians? Not so great, okay? In chapter 47, we're going to look at a little bit more on the subject of Joseph managing the famine crisis in Egypt and its impact on the Egyptians, on Joseph, and in particular the Pharaoh. We talked about this last week. What generally happened as they got deeper into the 7 years of famine? What happened regarding the Egyptians and the Egyptians and Pharaoh, the government? So Joseph had this great storehouse of grain, and so the people started buying it up. They spent all their money buying it up, and then they bartered and traded their livestock, and then finally what? Yeah, by surrendering what? The land. And they even said, we'll be your, as Jane Lou said, we'll be your slaves. And so what's gradually happening is that Pharaoh's regime is becoming more and more powerful. Ancient kings didn't own everything, okay? But there are certain arrangements where they ended up with the lion's share of stuff, and this is what happens here. And we made this point last week. Why is... You know, what's happening here with Pharaoh's dynasty, why is it happening? Well, one thing I would point you back to, very root cause, is Genesis 12:3. When God promised to Abraham, and thus through his descendants, I will bless those who bless you. Has Pharaoh been a blessing to Joseph, to Jacob, and the family? Oh, man. Can you name another king in the Old Testament outside the Hebrews who was better to the Hebrew people than this Pharaoh? I can't imagine one. You know, Nebuchadnezzar ends up being very good to Daniel and things like that, but it was just Daniel, and it was through a series of events, and at one time he's about to kill him. Pharaoh is very much blessed, okay? So, look here at what happens next. This is very interesting, I think, insightful. Les, can you read 47, 23 to 26? Let's pick up right here and how that there is a new order being shaped here. 23 to 26, please, Les.
And Joseph said to the people, "Indeed, I have brought you and your land this day for favor. Look, here is seed for you, and you shall sow the land. And it shall come to pass in the harvest that you shall give one-fifth to Pharaoh. Four-fifths shall be your own as seed for the field and for your food, for those who your household, and as food for your little ones." So they said, "You have saved our lives. Let us find favor in the sight of my Lord, and we will be Pharaoh's servants." And Joseph made it a law over the land of Egypt to this day that Pharaoh should have one-fifth except for the land of the priest only, which did not become Pharaoh's.
Okay, so evidently they're deep into the famine and they're approaching a period where it's going to be profitable to plant seed. And Pharaoh owns all the land. And so what's the arrangement? Now think about this. The people said, we'll be your servants. Look at Joseph's counteroffer to them. What's the arrangement? How much will... Yeah, you give one-fifth to Pharaoh. Okay? They're going to be able to work the same land, be provided with seed, which is the grain, to produce the crops, and they get to keep four-fifths of the crops. What kind of deal does that sound like to you? Oh, man. We would call this, in American historic terms, what kind of arrangement? I mentioned this last week.
Sharecropping.
Sharecropping. Exactly right. Which really accelerated after the Civil War because the South and certain places even toward the West, was the owners were land rich and money poor. And so they had arrangements for farmers to work the land they own. And matter of fact, though, it's very common for freed slaves to end up in this arrangement as sharecroppers. Most sharecroppers were poor whites. Now, you may wonder, how does that system stack up with this? The little research, I couldn't remember it, but I had to do a little research. Usually in the American sharecropping system that was present in the South and a little bit places in the West like Oklahoma, it was usually a 50-50 split. The landowner got half of the crops and the farmers got half of the crops. And in that arrangement, usually the landowner supplied the seed, the tools, the mules, and the horses. Farmers who supplied their own mules and plows and tools might keep up to two-thirds of the crop. So think about that arrangement in this one. They got four-fifths. Now, according to what we just read there, how did this set with the people? Verse 25. They were appreciative. They were just pleased with this. You've saved us. Now, this system sounds oppressive to us. If somebody else owns the land, you got to hand over part of the crop and all that kind of thing. This is actually, there's a whole, a hopper of these things called coerced labor systems. Sharecropping's one. Chattel slavery is one. Indentured servitude is another one. And we understand the abuses that can accompany these things. But we've made this point in different studies we've had over the last several years. And I think this is a really good example that these coerced labor systems were produced by hard times. So would you want somebody to knock down your front door? Just come and kick it down. Just break it off the hinges. Would you like that? No. If your house was burning, would you like a fireman to do that? See the difference? So usually coerced labor systems, not always, but usually including slavery, were a product of difficult times that put people in hard conditions. And the options were either some kind of servitude where your options were limited and your rights were limited, or suffering also that could lead to death. Now, this is not an endorsement of slavery at all. Because in most cases, slavery ended up, or these kinds of systems ended up, being misused and people were oppressed in them. Because that's what humans do, right? Anytime humans get the upper leg on somebody, even in a capitalist system, they're going to abuse people. That's just what humans do. But I want you to see that this is what produced those kinds of arrangements. And you see here in this case, the Egyptians were pleased. But I would have you see that Joseph is extremely generous to them in getting four-fifths of the crops. Yeah, Rick?
Well, it's hard for me, and you may be going here, but it's hard for me to resist the parallel here spiritually. That we have basically squandered, used up all of our resources before God, and He has had mercy,
God's mercy
on us and given us the land, so to speak. I mean, blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of God. And it seems, that we have no leg to stand on, but He has been merciful to us.
He's merciful, very merciful. And this is what a wise administrator does, even in ancient times with authoritarian systems. He wins the goodwill of the people. Even if you have a monarchical system or some system like that, you still need the goodwill of the people backing you. And so Joseph sets up this dynasty. And so that's why there's such a jerk in another direction in Exodus 1 when a Pharaoh arose that knew not Joseph. And the best evidence points to this, by the way. I'm just going to throw this in here. And that is either this regime that is currently running Egypt or the next one was a foreign regime. There's a regime called the Hyksos regime. It was a group of foreign invaders that came into Egypt, took Egypt over, adopted Egyptian culture, like the Greeks did, Cleopatra, and then ruled over Egypt. By the time you get to Exodus 1, that dynasty, which actually had originated outside of Egypt, has been replaced. Or it's a dynasty that is outside of Egypt that's replacing the one that's native to Egypt. It's hard to know. People have different opinions. But that explains it. It's a different dynasty. It's a different ruling family. And so they don't have the obligation that this Pharaoh's dynasty had to Joseph, which put Pharaoh in such a powerful position. So we got to move on because we got to get to some other stuff because this is the last class. All right, so look at the last days here of Jacob, verse 27 to 31. Can you read that for us, Jesse, 27 to 31, please?
So Israel dwelt in the land of Egypt, in the country of Goshen, and they had possessions there and grew and multiplied exceedingly. And Jacob lived in the land of Egypt 17 years. So the length of Jacob's life was 147 years. When the time drew near that Israel must die, he called his son Joseph and said to him, "Now if I have found favor in your sight, please put your hand under my thigh and deal kindly and truly with me. Please do not bury me in Egypt. Let me lie with my fathers. You shall carry me out of Egypt and bury me in their burial place." And he said, "I will do as you have said." Then he said, "Swear to me." And he swore to him. So Israel bowed himself on the head of the bed.
Okay, how does this statement in verse 27 fit in with God's overall plan? That's right, they're going to multiply. God promised all the way back to Abraham, you're going to multiply, I'm going to bless you, all these kinds of things. This is we're seeing here in the last pages of Genesis, the actual fulfillment of things that had been promised in the earlier chapters for Abraham's descendants. And what role is Joseph in? The role that he continues to serve in this family. He's provider, he's leader. Though he's the 11th of 12 sons. Things get flipped. And so Jacob is approaching the end of his years. He lives to be 147. And he talks to Joseph about burying him back in Canaan. Little side point. And it's a biblical point. There, you get to a point in your life where you got more behind you than in front of you. And you got to be realistic about that. All these patriarchs were. You need to make arrangements. And I don't just mean your burial plot. I also mean in things that are really important, you need to make arrangements. And aging people who don't make arrangements are sticking their head in the sand. Because we know more about what lies behind death than anybody who's ever lived on this side of the cross, on this side of the New Testament. So we know that this is not where we're meant to be anyway. And so when it comes down to wrapping it up, let's wrap it up with the eye moving on to something way better. Jacob does this. Isaac does this. Abraham does this. So it's a biblical point. It's a biblical basic precedent here. All right, chapter 48. Andrew, can you read verses 1 to 6? Look what Jacob's doing next, talking about arrangements. 1 to 6, please.
Now it came after these things that Joseph was told, "Indeed, your father is sick." And he took with him his two sons, Manasseh and Ephraim. And Jacob was told, "Look, your son Joseph is coming to you." And Israel strengthened himself and sat up on the bed. Then Jacob said to Joseph, "God Almighty appeared to me at Luz in the land of Canaan and blessed me and said to me, 'Behold, I will make you fruitful and multiply you, and I will make of you a multitude of people and give this land to your descendants after you as an everlasting possession.' And now your two sons, Ephraim and Manasseh, who were born to you in the land of Egypt before I came to you in Egypt, are mine. As Reuben and Simeon, they shall be mine. Your offspring, whom you beget after them, shall be yours. They will be called by the name of their brothers in their inheritance."
All right, thank you. So chapters 48 and 49 really are a pair together, that it's all one, I guess, thematic topic here, and that is Jacob blessing his sons before he dies. Here first, he deals with Joseph, but not just Joseph. What is Jacob doing here with Ephraim and Manasseh? He's making them into two tribes who will have a position among the other brothers as what? Equal. Matter of fact, really more than equal.
Let's say dominant, at least to Simeon and Reuben.
What?
Dominant compared to Simeon and Reuben.
Right. So, exactly. So, why is Joseph's sons getting an equal position among the 12 tribes? I mean, why is Joseph's sons... Because they're Joseph's sons.
He paid dearly for what?
If not for Joseph.
Yeah, but Joseph paid dearly.
So I mean, if not for Joseph, where would they be? Of course, God did it, but did it through Joseph. And so, it's a little bit lost on us, but these people in Genesis, and many, many people in ancient times, and even throughout time, what happens to your descendants after you is a big deal. It's not as much how much you have in stocks and equities, but rather your children and grandchildren, what shape are they in? Not financially, but just in every way. That's the real heritage that you're leaving behind. And people are way more valuable than money. People can do more than money. And so... wow, they get this position. And then look at the blessing itself. Rick, will you read verse 9 to 12, please?
"And Joseph said to his father, 'They are my sons whom God has given me here.' So he said, 'Bring them to me, please, that I may bless them.' Now the eyes of Israel were so dim from age that he could not see. Then Joseph brought them close to him, and he kissed them and embraced them. And Israel said to Joseph, 'I never expected to see your face, and behold, God has let me see your children as well.' Then Joseph took them from his knees and bowed with his face to the ground."
All right, thank you. Jacob says, "Bring them that I may bless them." That I may bless them. When have we seen this previously? With whom? Jacob and Esau. Isaac calling for the oldest to come, Esau, and then Jacob supplanting him. Abraham does it too in some ways. And so it's this idea of passing on the blessing. And it's an incident with Jacob and Esau and Isaac that really highlights this, the power of the blessing. Once the blessing is given, it's given. So here's how I want you to see this. It's very clear in this text, but also in the text back with the supplanting of Esau's position. This is a God-ordained channel of blessings. When the patriarch blesses a son or sons, this is God's doing. And we know it's God's doing because along with a blessing given to that son and his descendants, he's describing what? Now, we haven't gotten into that. We will in a second. What?
The future.
Completely the future. You go back to the blessing that God through Isaac gave Jacob. It's about what's going to happen to Jacob. And he also gives a blessing to Esau, but it's not the position of superiority that Jacob would have. And we're going to see here in just a moment in 48 and 49 all these descriptions of the future of all these sons. So when someone is depicting the future with the power and the blessings of God, they're acting as what? Prophet. Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob are prophets, guys. They're prophets. He is prophesying here. So it's a channel of blessings and a prophecy that's being made. Okay? Now, look at this scene. Jacob kisses and embraces Manasseh and Ephraim, and they're sitting where? On his knees. Don't you get that picture? He's got these boys in his arms, on his knees. And then the blessing is coming, and so Joseph removes the boys so they can stand in front of him. And before Jacob blesses Ephraim and Manasseh, Joseph does what? Verse 12. He bows. Who bows? The person who now occupies what position? The highest position in Egypt, next to Pharaoh. Matter of fact, we read back when Pharaoh elevates him that he would go in the second chariot, and the announcement as Joseph went through the land was what? Bow the knee. Joseph bows before Jacob. Because Joseph knows what this moment means. And that is, Jacob is the patriarch. His father is the leader. And even more than that, this is a blessing that's coming through Jacob as a channel. But the source of the blessings, who? God. So see how Joseph knows this moment is reverent. And he bows. There's so many of these, what literature? These beautiful little scenes like Jacob and Esau reconciling. And I mean, these little pictures in your head, just stop and create the picture in your head. That's why I've never been a fan of pictures in a Bible. It's a box. God meant for the picture to be in here. That's why he gave us words. This is the greatest canvas in the world right here, your brain. And when you read things, as somebody said, the explosions are always bigger and the princesses are always more beautiful than in photos or drawings or film or something like that. The brain is so powerful. And so this is such a powerful scene here with Joseph and his fathers and the sons. Then, look what happens here. Rick, keep reading verse 13 to 19, please.
And Joseph took them both, Ephraim with his right hand toward Israel's left, and Manasseh with his left hand toward Israel's right, and brought them close to him. But Israel stretched out his right hand, and laid it on the head of Ephraim, who was the younger, and the left hand on Manasseh's head, crossing his hands, although Manasseh was born with the firstborn. And he blessed Joseph and said, "The God before whom my fathers Abraham and Isaac walked, the God who has been my shepherd all my life to this day, the angel who has redeemed me from all evil, bless the lads. And may my name live on in them, and the names of my fathers Abraham and Isaac, and may they grow into a multitude in the midst of the earth." When Joseph saw that his father laid his right hand on Ephraim's head, it displeased him. And he grasped his father's hand to remove it from Ephraim's head to Manasseh's head. And Joseph said to his father, "Not so, my father, for this one is the firstborn. Place your right hand on his head." But his father refused and said, "I know, my son, I know. He also shall become a people, and he also shall be great. However, his younger brother shall be greater than he, and his descendants shall become a multitude of nations."
All right, thank you. Evidently, the right-hand blessing was greater than the left-hand blessing. And the text is very clear, though earlier it's already listed, that Manasseh was the firstborn. And Jacob reverses it. Was this by accident? Jacob says, you know, Joseph thought, "Hey, Dad is old and can't see well. He's got the boys mixed up. I'll put him in the right place." Jacob's like, "No, son, I did this on purpose." The older before the younger? We've seen that before? Where? Sure. Well, Joseph becomes the superior in the family, de facto, and then Esau and Jacob. So it's a pattern already established. And why is this? I think this is the obvious thing, and that is humans develop a natural, well, as we say in chicken terms, pecking order. And human society is built on pecking orders. You know, people with degrees and people with money or experience or people in high position or the older. And all these are human, they're all based on fleshly things. The firstborn, first out, you know, first cross the finish line kind of thing. Even if your brother has the hill. And these are all fleshly human things. How does God do things differently? He doesn't do them. You know, think about Jesus.
Choosing of David.
David, prime example. Pass up all the older sons. I mean, look at Jesus. The greatest one to walk the earth was a nobody. No pedigree, no resources, no degrees, no training. We talked about the other night here, Wednesday night. Paul had extensive academic training in rabbinical learning. Paul had credentials. He had a great resume. But that resume he had amounted to what? What did he call it in Philippians 3?
Rubbish.
It's trash. The nobody was the somebody, Jesus of Nazareth. I mean, that's what ticked off those scribes and Pharisees. You're not a man of learning. You've not gone through our schools, our processes. And Jesus knew way more than they did. Jesus knew all. And so this is how God works. This is the pattern. So, and I think where that practically helps us, I think all of us need this lesson. I know I do. And that is, we have this tendency to think like, well, this is the way it's supposed to be. How many times do you think that? Well, this is the way it's supposed to be. Oh, really? Maybe not. Because God does things differently. He's got his own supposed to be way. I mean, are these stories not the most real things about living? You get inside these people's skins and walk in their sandals. I mean, this is it. This is our experience. They are us. We are them in so many ways. So, chapter 49, then shifts to Jacob blessing all the sons. I'm not going to read all this. I just want to highlight parts of it. Again, verse 1, Jacob said to his sons, gather yourselves together that I may tell you what shall happen to you in days to come. You see, this role of blesser is also a role of a prophet. And he's going to tell them what's going to happen in the future. I think we have time for this. Yeah, we do. Look at Vince, read verse 2 and 3, because he starts at the top. He starts with the firstborn. But look how things get all messed up here. Not messed up, but shuffled. So verse 2 and 3, Vince.
Gather together and hear, O sons of Jacob, and listen to Israel your father. Reuben, you are the firstborn, my might and the beginning of my strength, preeminent in dignity and preeminent in power.
3.
Yeah, yeah, okay. That was a mistake. Verse 4. Go ahead.
Uncontrolled as water, you shall not have preeminence, because you went up to your father's bed. Then you defiled it. He went up to my couch.
All right, thank you. Thank you for helping me out on that. Look how he describes Reuben. He's the firstborn. So inherently, look at the descriptions. My might, first fruits of strength, preeminent. That's what he's supposed to be. But he references the Bilhah incident, who was the concubine that Reuben went into when they came down the land of Canaan, which was probably an act of passion, but it's also an act, hard to read it otherwise, of asserting himself as the leader of the family. And it cost him. It cost him the position of leader in the family. Do you see what Jacob is able to do here? But again, he's a prophet. Jacob is actually able to make the call who gets to be the preeminent one. And again, I think this is God using him as a channel and as a prophet. So it cost him. All right, keep going, Vince. Verse 5 to 7, please.
Simeon and Levi are brothers. Their swords are implements of violence. Let my soul not enter into their council. Let not my glory be united with their assembly. Because in their anger they slew men, and in their self-will they lamed oxen. Cursed be their anger, for it's fierce, and their wrath, for it is cruel. I will disperse them in Jacob and scatter them in Israel.
Thank you. So next two sons, Simeon and Levi, are talked about in the incident of Dinah. Dinah was the sister who, when they came to the land of Canaan, was violated. And so they tricked the city. The king of the city was the father of the son who violated her, or the father of the son who violated her. And they tricked the city and had them circumcised and then waylaid into them and attacked the city and killed people. So you can understand that indeed Dinah was violated. A wrong was done. An atrocious evil was committed. But how is their action depicted here?
Fierce.
Fierce, violent, cruel. They're out of control in their anger. Justice cannot be a volcano that erupts. And that's what they did. They erupted on this. Shechem was a city, right? So what happened to them? Well, they're told that they're going to be divided into verse 7 and scattered. By the way, note that scatter them in Israel. Oh, the term Israel now is used for a land, a place. I think it might be the first reference to it as a place rather than the man Israel or Jacob. So what happens to Levi is that he becomes the priestly tribe, did not receive a land allotment, and the Levites were scattered throughout the land of Israel in different cities. Simeon's land allotment, because they were a small tribe, was put in the middle of Judah's land allotment. And over time, Judah just swallowed it up, and Simeon was just assimilated into Judah and basically lost their identity. Wow. All right, Vince, keep rolling. 8 to 10, please.
Judah, your brothers shall praise you. Your hand shall be on the neck of your enemies. Your father's son shall bow down to you. Judah is a lion's whelp. From the prey, my son, you have gone up. He crouches, he lies down as a lion, and as a lion, who dares rouse him up? The scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor the ruler's staff from between his feet, until Shiloh comes. And to him shall be the obedience of the peoples.
All right, that's good. Thank you. There's more about Judah, but that suffices it. What rule, Judah's number four in the family, what role will he occupy, it says?
His neck will be on his enemies.
Right, he's going to be triumphant,
preeminent.
He's going to hold in his hand the what, verse 10?
Scepter.
What's a scepter? Symbol of a ruler.
You know, if this were coming straight from Jacob, he wouldn't have chosen Judah.
I don't think so.
He would have chosen Joseph.
I think so. So, but as readers of the text the last few weeks, and Judah was instrumental in that Genesis 37 where Joseph was captured and sold, but in the last few chapters, what role has Judah occupied? The Redeemer, the Protector. He's willing to offer himself to protect Benjamin, the favorite son. He's the sacrificial leader. The sacrificial leader. Okay? Scepter. The king servant. The servant king. David will come from the tribe of Judah. The dynasty of David will come from Judah. And eventually, the Messiah. Christ. So, it's like, this chapter casts a shadow on the rest of the Bible, doesn't it? So, Zebulun is talked about being near the sea. That's where Zebulun's allotment came to be, near the Mediterranean coastline. Just a couple of highlights. Look at Joseph, because this is, just love this language about Joseph here. Vince, read verse 22 to 26.
Joseph is a fruitful bough by spring. Its branches run over the wall. And the archers bitterly attacked him and shot at him and harassed him. But his bow remains firm, and his arms were agile. From the hands of the mighty one of Jacob, from there is the shepherd, the stone of Israel.
from the God of your fathers who helps you, and by the Almighty who blesses you, with blessings of heaven above, blessings of the deep that lies beneath, blessings of the breast and of the womb. 26 too?
Yeah.
Okay. The blessings of your father have surpassed the blessings of my ancestors, up to the utmost bound of the everlasting hills. May they be on the head of Joseph and on the crown of the head of the one distinguished among his brothers.
Okay, thank you very much. What language, right? Verse 23, the archers attacked him, shot at him, harassed him, but his bow remained unmoved. Okay. Joseph experienced the worst things, but he passed the tests, and he was the strong, stable, triumphant one. And so he's being blessed here. And this language, and this is like Rick was talking about a while ago, he receives here the greatest praise and in a way the greatest blessings outside of Judah in this situation. But of course, we know how it's fulfilled. It's fulfilled through Manasseh and Ephraim, who become two of the most dominant tribes, Ephraim and Manasseh, in land area and in population, etc. And so they become more dominant than the others in a way outside of Judah. And so Joseph is richly blessed. And then Benjamin's described as a warrior. And sure enough, Benjamin, we get later in Israelite history, the Benjaminites were known for their warfare and their handling of weapons, of which Saul came from Benjamin, and Saul's popularity was built on his triumphs in battle. So this is all prophetic here, what's going to happen to this family. Wow. You start with this one man, Abraham, and then this is the scene before them. It's going to happen. It's just grand, isn't it? And then we come to the end of the chapter and the beginning of the next chapter. Zachary, once you read for us, starting in chapter 49, verse 49-33, and read down to chapter 50, verse 3, please.
When Jacob finished commanding his sons, he drew up his feet into the bed and breathed his last and was gathered to his people. Then Joseph fell on his father's face and wept over him and kissed him. And Joseph commanded his servants, the physicians, to embalm his father. So the physicians embalmed Israel. 40 days were required for it, for that is how many are required for embalming. And the Egyptians wept for him for 70 days.
It's another one of those tender and powerful scenes, the death of Jacob, and that Joseph is there, as God told Jacob, Joseph will close your eyes. It's an euphemism for he'll be there at your deathbed. I don't know if, how many of you have experienced that and the necessity of doing that to the eyes, okay? But it happens. So Joseph was there, and then he gave command for embalming. Some people have questions about this. I'll just say this really quickly. This is not the kind of embalming that we're accustomed to. Basically, where the Egyptians did it, and it was only for the elite, by the way. Average person, they just took them out in the desert and put them in the sand. The elite, they harvested the organs and did all these things they did to the body. Basically, they removed the organs and put them in these like preservation jars and things such as that. What we know is IV embalming. The first stages of it was the 16th century, but what we know today is embalming really emerges around the American Civil War in the 19th century. And it's because of the American Civil War that it did, because they were trying to get bodies back home, and that's why they came up with a method to do that, a doctor did. So it's a different kind of embalming, but they are going to carry him to Egypt. You see, this is probably a practical reason why Joseph has him embalmed, whatever that process exactly meant, because they're going to take him all the way, his body all the way to Canaan, rather than in quickly putting him into a grave or a tomb. And you'll see in chapter 50, at the end of verse 9, it was a very great company that went up to Canaan with Joseph and his brothers taking the body of his father. And it says in verse 11, when the Canaanites saw the mourning, that it's a grievous mourning by the Egyptians. And so this was a big ordeal. I wish I could have factored this into my Jacob series, but I did enough. But this, the funeral of Jacob was a humdinger. And it's because of Joseph. And so he got royal burial honors. That's what he got. Just what a story, right? But as it's all winding down, there's a concern. Zachary, keep reading for us. Chapter 50. Please read verse 14 to 21 when they all get back to Egypt. 14 to 21, please.
After he had buried his father, Joseph returned to Egypt with his brothers and all who had gone up with him to bury his father. When Joseph's brothers saw that their father was dead, they said, "It may be that Joseph will hate us and pay us back for all the evil that we did to him." So they sent a message to Joseph saying, "Your father gave this command before he died. Say to Joseph, please forgive the transgression of your brothers and their sin because they did evil to you. Now please forgive the transgression of the servants of the God of your father." Joseph wept when they spoke to him. His brothers also came and fell down before him and said, "Behold, we are your servants." But Joseph said to them, "Do not fear, for am I in the place of God? As for you, you meant evil against me, but God meant it for good, to bring it about that many people should be kept alive as they are today. So do not fear. I will provide for you and your little ones." Thus he comforted them and spoke kindly to them.
All right. Thank you. Boy, those brothers do a lot of bowing in front of Joseph, don't they? Why would they think this way, the brothers? Why would they have this concern?
They were so guilty.
They were so guilty. Matter of fact, they even used the term, quoting their father, "Because they did evil to you." They quote that. They are embracing the evil they'd done to Joseph. So look at the appeal they make. They quote their father. Legitimately, I think we can understand that. So, that Jacob gives commands for Joseph to forgive them. What insight would Jacob have about that experience? His brother had finally what? Forgiven him of the evil he committed against him. I mean, that's the picture there of the reuniting of Jacob and Esau. They've reconciled. So Jacob knows how important that is to reconcile. And so he gives commands that Joseph... It's not fair, is it? But that's just how it works. The person who is the victim has to do the hard thing. The oppressors don't have to do the hard thing. The victim does. That's not the way it's supposed to be, is it? There's that term again. And had Joseph given them any reason to think otherwise, that he would not forgive them?
They've got to respect his power and authority in his position. And I'm sure they're like, wow, he could just wipe us out.
Well, he did throw Simeon in jail.
I mean, he did. All right, so you got three things here, I think, at work. And you guys have identified two. First of all, Joseph had tested them at first, including what he did to Simeon, okay? And all the gyrations that he put him through, okay? But also along the way, he had consistently done what for them? Protected and provided for them abundantly. But they also know he has absolute power over them in every way. But what does Joseph do? What's the first thing that he does when he hears this appeal? Yeah, he weeps. He weeps. Joseph's got a tender heart, doesn't he? And then he says, "Am I in the place of God?" He gets it. Doesn't Joseph always get it? How he reacted to Potiphar's house, how he dealt with Pharaoh, how he deals with his brothers. Joseph gets it. This is what God wants me to do. And then the book ends here with his burial, with his death, and him giving instructions to take him and bury him in the land of Canaan. When is his body finally taken and buried in Canaan? When the Israelites are released from Egyptian bondage 400 years later, and they go to Canaan. Thank you for studying this book with me and journeying with me with all these incredible stories. Thank you very much.